areas of Antarctica might be experiencing similar impact. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Hey, thank you, Frederick Carter, another new member. Thank you very much. Keep your pledges coming in. If you want to put Don't Forget the Blues on the next show, it's fine. You can tell them whoever you're pledging to or all shows. Thank you so much, 202-588-9739. Two new members.
WPFW Washington.
Good afternoon. I'm Parisa Neruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday bringing the information and inspiration that you need to take action in our city to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC. We welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call Empower DC at 202-234-9119. Listeners, it is really great to join you again this Tuesday. I have been trying to figure out how long we've been doing Taking Action, and I just looked in my archives and looks like it's been about 10 years. So since 2014, we've been bringing you information every week, highlighting local campaigns, ways that you can get involved. And of course, we can only do this because WPFW serves as that platform, that pillar of access to this type of information. And we are so grateful for WPFW. 47 years of education for liberation is the theme of this spring pledge drive, and I hope all of our listeners will consider making a contribution, any amount that you're able, to sustain WPFW for another 47 years, to help the station grow and move into a new space soon, and just to show your support. We understand that majority of our listeners, probably over 90%, have not donated. So if everybody did just chip in a little bit, we would be doing so well and so great, and we'd be able to ensure the long-term future of the station. So please, again, during our hour, we are hoping to raise $600. That's our goal. You can call 202-588-9739 or go online to wpfwfm.org to contribute. So I just want to get that out of the way. I'll remind you a little bit later, but please, again, help us celebrate a decade of Taking Action and 47 years of WPFW. By contributing during our hour. And I'm really excited to have somebody who I deeply respect and admire, somebody who I've gotten to work with for probably about 20 years now. Amber Harding is my guest today. She is the executive director of the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless, does incredible work fighting for housing and to ensure that the city's housing programs make sense and they serve people in a way that is just and dignified. And so, Amber, I want to thank you and welcome you once again on the airwaves. Thanks for joining me, Amber Harding.
Thanks for having me, Parisa. And you just reminded me that the last time that I was here talking about rapid rehousing with one of my colleagues, it was also during fundraising, and his mom actually called in and contributed to WPFW while he was talking about his work. So
that's right.
We have a long history of working, being on the show, Taking Action, and working with Empower to seek housing justice for DC residents.
Yes, we do, Amber. And, you know, I don't know if you've been on since you came into your new position of executive director. So why don't you give the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came into this work? Because you've been working at the Washington Legal Clinic now for about 20 years, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
21 years. Yeah.
21 years. Okay, go for it. Let us know a little bit about your background.
Thanks. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm one of those rare people who actually went to law school to do precisely what I'm doing right now. But it started when I grew up in Arizona and I went to University of Arizona. And when I was a senior in college, I was an anthropology major and I did field work interviewing homeless youth that were living on the street in Tucson, Arizona. And that experience, I think, radicalized me to what was happening with homelessness in a way that I just, these are people who are my age, right? They had, you know, these very different life experiences, and they told me about, you know, police abuse and not being allowed to use bathrooms or even buy food in public spaces. And it just seemed like the amount of abuse and discrimination against people experiencing homelessness was something not a lot of people knew about. And I threw away all my grad school applications and said to myself, okay, I got to do something more directly to help this situation. And so I didn't know a single lawyer at that time. I had never even considered going to law school. I ended up coming to law school here in DC to, you know, commit to working on strengthening the legal and civil rights of people experiencing homelessness. And here I am, 24 years later after moving here, still doing that work. So I was an attorney at the legal clinic for many years before our founder and executive director retired in 2022. And I became executive director at that time. And so the legal clinic, you know, we're an interesting group. We are a feisty, medium-sized nonprofit that doesn't take any public money and has, I think, a really strong voice in this work as a result. And we, you know, are a legal service provider, but we have three streams of work. We do direct legal services to people mainly on housing and shelter issues, but a lot of civil legal issues. We do a tremendous amount of policy and advocacy work that arises out of those interactions with our client population. And we do community engagement and advocacy with the client community. So we do Know Your Rights. We do you know, outreach in encampments and shelters and day programs, and help people learn how to advocate and help access decision makers. And one of the things I think that also is really important to us in sort of our framework for doing this is, you know, a lot of that like organizing and mobilizing grows out of legal work, because legal work expanding and enforcing people's legal rights is a really empowering process, right? So you're saying like you, the person who is generally like subject to government rules and regulations, are the person who gets to like enforce your rights, and the person who gets to say, actually, I have, you know, I share the same rights as anyone else, even though I am someone who is, you know, has very low income or is experiencing homelessness. And I think that's generally been for a lot of our clients a really empowering process to go through, to be able to, you know, sort of stand on equal ground and say, you know, the law applies equally to me.
Well, I want to thank you for that long service that you've put in. The city is better for you having moved here and taken on this work. And, you know, you are one of the few people who has that sort of longevity and institutional knowledge. So we'll tap into that a little bit as we talk about what we're dealing with right now in the city this budget year, where the mayor has said that we all should feel the pain. Although if you're a sports team owner or a downtown developer, you don't have to feel pain, but the people already feeling the pain should feel the pain of having to suffer additional cuts to social service programs. And so we're going to talk about that. But one of the issues that the Washington Legal Clinic has really been a leader on for many years is the issues related to rapid rehousing. And one of the reasons why you're on today is to really raise the alarm of disaster that's coming to bear with the mayor allowing over 2,000 families to lose their housing assistance. Before we get into those details, can you just share with us a little bit of that background? Explain what this rapid rehousing program is and what the mayor is proposing.
Sure. So rapid rehousing came about as a national model post-2008 recession. And the idea was that you could have short-term rental assistance and services to get back on your feet after losing a job. So the idea was, you know, these were people because of the recession who could, if they got a job, they would be able to afford their housing again. The problem is when you apply that model to high rent jurisdictions like DC, where, you know, you have to work 75 hours a week at a minimum wage job in order to afford a two bedroom apartment, it's really just not the right match to what our housing affordability is here. So in DC, it was unfortunately expanded into sort of the one size fits all program it is today, where it is the program that people, particularly families, move out of shelter into. And because of that, you know, you've got people who just they're going to need more than one job, right? It's not just one job. And we find that the program really doesn't work at all. It used to be we thought the program didn't work well for the majority of families. Now we're looking at numbers that are more like 99% failure rate of the program when you look at whether people are able to afford rent on their own after 12 months in the program. So, you know, for us, it was always a program that didn't match up with reality. I think another reason that it's been an important program for us to reform is it's been really poisoned by some racist and classist myths that undergird it. So it started out as a program that said, the policymaker said, if we give you a long-term subsidy, you just won't be motivated enough to increase your income. So we're going to give you a cliff. And we're going to threaten you with that cliff. And that is what you need to be motivated to increase your income. And that's like a really long-standing racist and classist myth, often sort of referred to as like welfare queen kind of myth. When in reality, people that are who need housing assistance are just as motivated to raise their income as anyone else. And the idea that you would have to force people into doing what is best for their family by threatening them with losing their housing is, you know, pretty paternalistic and awful. And so from the beginning, we've seen that play out where there's a lot of blaming the individual for really systemic problems in the city of like lack of affordable housing. And we've been pushing to say, hey, if you look at the numbers, you'll see people aren't able, there's just too big of a gap between income and rent. And a short-term program isn't going to resolve that long-term affordability problem.
Yeah, thank you for bringing in the underlying classism and racism. I really think that those classist attitudes that have been perpetuated by even our Black elected officials are fundamentally one of the biggest issues that we have in the city that underlies so many of the things that we talk about. And it really has been on display, I think, this budget season with some of the comments made by the mayor in the context of emergency rental assistance, claiming that people are cheating or gaming the system, you know, people who could be paying rent or just getting, you know, asking for rental assistance with no proof whatsoever. She has showed no proof of this. Plus the fact that those payments go directly to landlords. So it's not like people are lining their pockets, but those attitudes are, you know, it's shocking to see some of them gaining steam. And like you said, some of those attitudes have been built into programs like this. And I wonder, you know, just from your long-term perspective, do you see some of those attitudes? Is that sort of just a steady thing that you've seen throughout the 20 plus years, or is it getting worse? Have you seen any improvement? Because that is definitely underlying, a lot of our challenges.
I mean, those like those myths and stereotypes and trying to eradicate them are what drew me to this work, just the tremendous need to have those conversations, to talk about, you know, the experiences that people had. So I think that's pretty prevalent across the country, not just in DC. You do see this administration, though, seems more bold in saying it out loud than prior administrations that I've experienced in DC. You know, we certainly saw that in the we've seen this in the when DC General was closing, and we were talking about the need that families were identifying that they didn't want to share bathrooms with strangers. Mm-hmm. It was raised that if you gave people private bathrooms, they would stay in shelter longer. So you definitely have seen that kind of messaging for like really basic needs framed as luxuries or things that would make people feel too comfortable. I think that's it's really concerning rhetoric, because I think, you know, the mayor wants to do some good things for this population and undermines her own efforts when she, you know, it made it actually harder to open new shelters because she had spent a year with harmful rhetoric around who lives in shelters as a way to justify some of the other things she wanted to do. And then she went into the very neighborhoods to open new shelters and found neighbors repeating that rhetoric, right? Like it is something that like poisons the public narrative too. It makes it harder to do good work in the city, even when the mayor, you know, does align with us as far as like, you know, opening new shelters or building affordable housing. Now it's harder because now people are saying, but you said people don't really need these services, that, you know, that they're gaming the system. The emergency rental assistance comments I thought were particularly galling, because one of the things she said, which I actually agree with, is that there are a decent number of people who use emergency rental assistance because they don't have access to long-term vouchers and housing assistance. Mm-hmm. That is a true fact. And she funded no new vouchers in the budget. So you can't both like not fund the program and then blame people for using the only program that they have access to so that they can stay in their housing. That's not an abuse of the program. This is the only resource that was funded that helps people in this situation. If she actually funded long-term vouchers, she's right. There would be eventually be fewer people who needed eviction prevention funds. That's kind of the point, right? Mm-hmm. But to do that while not funding it and while proposing cutting 2,200 families off of their rental support into a situation where, you know, they're going to need eviction prevention was just, you know, driving those numbers up while claiming that the need is overblown is to me just shockingly hypocritical.
So what do we know about the 2,200 families who are facing this loss of housing assistance?
So we estimate it's about 5,500 kids that will be impacted. I will say, just to back up a little bit, those terminations are happening now. We already see people who are getting terminated that we're representing. Mm-hmm. And they will go through the end of July. So 2,200 families is over 3 months. And then there will be another 1,000 families terminated next year. So it's not like we're done. The plan is to terminate, to keep on budget. The plan is to terminate over 1,000 families every year, knowing they can't afford rent, and then to put over 1,000 new families into the program. Some of those new families they're putting in are the very families who have been terminated in the past from this program. We see people go through it repeatedly. So that's what's happening right now. Those 2,200 families, though, we know are very, very low income. Their average monthly income is about $1,300 a month, but 65% of them are on temporary assistance for needy families. So their incomes are much lower than that. We know 97% of them have identify as Black. We know a lot of them are people who have a disability of someone in the household. Many of them qualify for permanent supportive housing or other programs if they were available. And we know that really like 0.01% of them will be able to afford rent when they lose their housing subsidy. So we know that they will rack up rent. They'll either leave or they'll get evicted. Many of them will return to homelessness. Many of them will return to shelter. There won't be enough shelter for 2,200 families or even a tenth of 2,200 families. So, you know, we're really looking at a pretty huge family homelessness crisis of the mayor's making. And so I think I'm struggling to see what the plan is or what the, you know, whether people have really thought through the long-term consequences of this. You know, the mayor's also really been talking about like truancy and absenteeism, like, but like the number one factor for truancy is homelessness. It's like the number one predicting factor. So we know that giving people stable housing prevents truancy and absenteeism and increases graduation rates and increases test scores, like all the things for kids, improves mental, physical health. Like, you know, homelessness is honestly, it is one of the most damaging things that can happen to a child. And so, you know, all these families that are in rapid rehousing have already experienced homelessness, and now they're going to have a second round. And that just feels completely inhumane and immoral to me when we could prevent it.
I agree with you. I think it is inhumane and immoral, especially then to not make those connections that you just made. You know, the city, wants to talk about education outcomes, for instance, or juvenile crime or whatever it is, but we're not making these, you know, so such clear connections. And restate that estimate of how many young people would be impacted by these terminations.
We're estimating about 5,500 children.
So those are 5,500 children that have already experienced homelessness that were not this year classified as homeless children because they were in housing, who will now be again classified as homeless children. And how many homeless children do we account for already in this public school system? I believe it's generally over 6,000.
I think it was I thought it was in the 5,000. So it would roughly double the number of homeless children in DCPS.
Yeah. And so that conversation, you know, is not happening in those spaces where so many of these kids are, you know, living and, you know, for instance, do the schools know, do the teachers know, does the community at large know? Because to be honest, Amber, you're the only organization that I have seen raising this issue. I mean, others have joined you to raise the call, but your Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless has been the leading voice on the rapid rehousing program. Many advocates are talking about other also important programs, but the disaster that you are, you know, unveiling to us, that you're showing us is happening. You really are providing information that I'm not seeing coming from others. So I mean, I thank you, but I also, it's not the best position, right, to have to be the bearer of bad news. Why do you think that this information is so limited? Why do so few of us know what's happening with this?
Oh, I honestly feel like there's so much bad news out there right now that I think it gets overwhelming for people. And I mean, we were watching the budget work session last week, and many council members raised housing as an issue, and several raised rapid rehousing. And one of the advocates that was on, we were in like a group watching it. One of the advocates was like, I don't want to hear anything else about rapid rehousing. It's so depressing.
And that's the advocate.
And that's it, right. And that is correct, because it is so bleak to talk about what is being done to those families and what happens, because this isn't the first time we've had this conversation. This is just the highest number of families impacted in 1 year. But we have certainly been raising the alarm for many years about this. And I think, you know, for the legal clinic, these are our clients. Like right now, we have dozens of families coming to us for legal assistance. We are representing them. We are working with them. The families we meet in family shelters are often people who have gone through the program before and don't want to go back. We have organized with families that were in rapid rehousing. They helped develop the legislation that is pending at the council that would reform this program. So for us, it's our priorities come from our clients, and it's a very, very clear priority from our clients that this is a harmful program. This is the first housing program in our history of an organization over, almost 40 years we have ever advocated to reduce funding to. We're always out there like, put more money in housing programs. And then for the last, 5, 10 years, we've been like, accept rapid rehousing, because people come out. Yes, it is better than shelter for the time period they're in it. But there is something, I think everyone recognizes how traumatic eviction is, but there is something so awful about a recurring homelessness for a family, and having that eviction now on their record makes their life harder now than it was before they went into the program to begin with, because now they go back to shelter, or maybe they bounce around, people go back to abusers, all sorts of unsafe settings. But now when they go to try to find housing, they now have that eviction on a fresh eviction on their record that's going to make it so much harder to get housing again. They might unpaid debt to a landlord they have to figure out what to do with. Their credit might be worse. It's just any progress that was made just disappears, and they're in a worse situation than before they went into the program. Mm.
I'm going to pause for a minute to remind our listeners that we are in the Spring Pledge Drive. We do want to sustain WPFW as this important institution that has allowed us to bring this information to the air, 10 years of taking action, and so many other important programs. If you can dig into your pocket and donate something to support WPFW, this pledge drive, maybe consider becoming a monthly sustaining donor. That way it's an automatic thing. You don't have to think about it. Please call 202-588-9739 or go online to WPFWFM.org. And our goal this hour is $600. Empower DC is going to take care of half of that. So we'll donate $300, and we really appreciate our listeners helping us make up the other half. Please, again, 202-588-9739 or WPFWFM.org. So, Amber, can you explain anything behind why the mayor is proposing such a drastic measure now? Is this just to balance the budget, or is there anything else behind this? Because, again, we talked about the attitudes, right. the classism and the attitudes. So I just wonder, is there anything else beyond this? Is it just, hey, we need to cut the budget, and here's a program we can eliminate people from?
I mean, I'm loath to even speculate as to what goes on in the administration and like what their motivation is. I will say that what happened in the pandemic is they stopped terminating families, which was great. As a result, the program grew. And instead of having a plan to sort of bring it back down to a certain level or invest affordable housing to exit people into, I think we can all agree that the program is too large, and we can disagree with how to make it smaller. And the mayor's way of making it smaller is to cut $40 million from it in 1 year and terminate 2,200 families. And I think most of us would have picked a gentler slope and into permanent housing and support. So I think, a lot of programs got cut this year. She calls it right sizing. And that's where I think, again, like, we could agree that the program should be right sized. The program is too big. But our version of right sizing is, yes, what the community actually needs is more long-term affordable housing choices, and this isn't a long-term affordable housing choice. So right-sizing it, to me, means transitioning people into those other programs. To me, right-sizing is never cutting. I mean, it's two-thirds of the program getting cut off in 1 year, and planning to just cycle the same number of people in that you cycle out every year just feels unnecessarily cruel and short-sighted. To me, that is a very, very bad plan. It's a budget issue, but there's always been an ideology difference between advocates and family members. And then with the administration, they have, honestly, I think believed in kind of some magical math out there for why anyone would be able to afford rent when they're terminated. And so, you know, all the consequences of the failing of program fall on the families. I think that's something we really want to shift. And I think the council is more aligned with us on that, that we can't keep having failing programs where the consequences only fall on the participants. There has to be some accountability for the government when the government creates programs that so clearly don't work for people.
So importantly, we want to inform the listeners about how they can join the Washington Legal Clinic in calling for these cuts to be stopped. What is exactly the Legal Clinic asking for at this moment, and how can people echo your calls?
So right now we're asking the council to take immediate action in the budget process to stop the time limit terminations and ensure that there are sufficient housing subsidies out there that they can transition people into, mm-hmm. which is, it's a big ask, but also it's one that should have happened years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have a email action on our website at www.legalclinic.org. You can get to it by, it's either on the front page, but that scrolls, or you can hit action alert and it's the second one down. Mm-hmm. You can also just email your council member, like really any council member, and ask them to make this a top priority. It is an issue that council, I think, is aligned with us on, but I think the issue is are they aligned enough, and do they care enough to actually make it happen? Because it's going to take, unfortunately, at this point in time, it's going to take a tremendous amount of resources to be added to housing programs. In order to avoid all these terminations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, either that or a tremendous amount of resources to repair all the harm done to families later down the road. So, you know, it's definitely, I think, short-sighted, you know, to cause this trauma and suffering to families now. And you know, how much does it cost if they go back into the shelter system?
Well, and, you know, we have in D.C., we have a legal right to shelter when it's freezing outside. So while there aren't enough shelter beds for families right now, and they don't have a legal right to those beds, come next winter, they'll have a legal right to them, which means the city will have to open up hotels, which they do not want to do, or they will have to find some other space for families. And I keep saying families because the majority of people are getting terminated are families, but this impacts individuals as well. We are in our reform and our asks also impacts individuals. So like we will also see that individuals will lose their rapid rehousing as well. That's just baked into the design of the program.
Mm-hmm. And will you continue to call for this program to ultimately be eliminated and transition to more permanent types of housing support?
So we're asking the council to pass and fund the Rapid Rehousing Reform Amendment Act. And what that does is say you can't exit anyone unless they can pay market rent.
Mm.
And I think that will get to a smaller program eventually, mm-hmm. because I think that forces the administration to actually plan with the realistic needs of the families in mind. And it forces them maybe to better select who goes into the program instead of it being the only program anyone gets, you know, that there are other housing programs that you could enter into from shelter. So I think over time we would see sort of the natural rebalancing of the housing ecosystem if that bill were passed. We've been, that bill has had a hearing. It's with Robert White's committee. We're pushing to have elements of it put into the budget now, but it really is something we can't every single year be in this position of crisis and right. then having people say, oh, yeah, we don't have enough time to figure out how to do that because it's budget season, or there's not enough money to take care of these families because, oh, it's a tight budget year. Like every year, that's kind of the story. And we get little piecemeal reform that might mitigate the harm a little bit. But we need to actually reform the program like permanently and not have to keep doing this every year. And some of these things have been part of this advocacy for many years because they have been in and out of this program.
Agreed. So everybody, listeners, again, go to legalclinic.org, and on the homepage, you'll see at the very top a rotating screen, or you can go to Action Alert, and just you'll see the action. You'll see more information about this and the CLIF, and you can do an action where you email the council members, and every email helps. Even if you don't do it through the website, if you want to pick up the phone, if you want to call your council member's office, that's another way to just let folks know that this is important to you. If you're a Twitter person, you can send a tweet out. You can look on the Legal Clinic's Twitter account. There's a link there as well. So please, everybody, if you can just take a minute to join in the chorus of people saying this is the wrong decision, that would be really helpful. And I, you know, it's just sort of ironic that the mayor came in to office initially saying that ending homelessness was one of her top priorities. What is your take then? Now she's in her third term. How would you describe her record on housing and homeless issues?
I would definitely say that she made a much stronger effort on homelessness in her first term than she has since. She committed money to programs. You know, we disagreed with some of how she closed DC General, but we agreed with the broad scope aspects of replacing it and opening new and smaller shelters. I think those are nice shelters. We agree with like how she now is committed to opening a couple non-congregate shelters for individuals and renovating some other shelters. So I think that those are the positives, but her commitment to funding affordable housing and really targeting that and ending homelessness has really gone down over the years. And she might be the under the mayor's. So I have done this advocacy under Mayor Williams, Fendi, Gray, and Bowser. And I think she probably is the harshest on street homelessness of any of those mayors. We have these regular clearings of encampments. She's creating, quote, no tent zones all over the city that are just weird black holes of constitutional rights, you know, where like it's only enforcement is really limited or focused on people who are homeless. You know, those are pretty harmful. You know, sort of this constant displacement of people is harmful, obviously, but also is just there's no legitimate purpose to it, in the sense that like you displace people, they're harmed, but you have not ended homelessness. You have not stopped encampments. You've not achieved any ostensibly legitimate end with it. And so I don't even know if I could say we disagree on a policy level, because I'm not sure what the policy is at this point. We obviously disagree if the only policy is to harm people, but I don't think anyone thinks that it's effective to constantly displace people. And I think, you know, encampments and rapid rehousing are sort of similar, right? Where the approach is like, you don't have a right to be here, so we're going to terminate you. And we're not going to think about what happens next. And as a result, I think sometimes that it feels like a lot of people feel, and a lot of people in rapid rehousing are told, if you cannot afford to live here, you should just go live somewhere else. Like the case managers will actually tell people, well, go rent in Maryland. And that's a reasonable decision for someone to make. It is not an okay policy for a government-funded program to push people out of the city, right? Like that feels pretty different than just somebody deciding on their own that they don't want to live here anymore. So I think like the continued displacement of low-income, primarily Black and Brown residents of the city has been a real failure of the administration. And I think uncontrollable rent in the city is a failure. Like you can't talk about ending homelessness without talking about rent. we don't really have meaningful rent control. We have just out of control prices in the city for everybody. But, you know, the people at the low end of the income bands are the ones that struggle the most there. And I think that's a real failure. So where we've been aligned has sometimes been where our interests are aligned with developers, unfortunately. So you see that sometimes there have been, you know, there have been attempts at funding subsidies or funding development that has a small portion dedicated to affordable housing. But that's not enough to even tread water with the loss of affordable housing that we have every year.
What would it mean for the city to pass a policy that declares a right to housing? And what's the history of that type of right to housing policy in DC or anywhere in the nation?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I wish we had the political will to make that happen. And I do think that it is what has to happen for things to ever be different, because, you know, let's say that Mayor Bowser was an amazingly committed, everything she did was to end homelessness, but she's not going to be in office forever. And then she leaves and all that could get undone, right? So having, you know, an actual legislated right to housing is different. It can still be undone by politicians, but it takes a lot more to undo it. Right now, the only access to housing is sort of an annual budget fight. That can, you know, shift every year, different priorities change, different players. But a legislated funded right to housing means it becomes part of our baseline. It becomes part of our core services as a city. Means people can access housing when they need it, right? Depending on how it's written. Some countries, we don't really have local models in the United States for us. Some countries have a model for right to housing that phases people in. So it'll take like priority populations and say, you know, in the first 5 years, you will make sure everyone in this category has access to housing, and then phases people in over time. That's probably something that would have to happen here, because the scope of it is pretty, but I think if you had something like that, here's my like vision of this. If you had something like that, you create incentives in all these other areas too. Because if the city actually had to fund a right to housing, then the city's going to go, well, you know what would help is if we actually had like education and employment services that help people raise their income, because then, man, we'd have to pay less rent, right? Like, it would help if we had, you know, some public housing available that people could access, because that seems like a more efficient way. You know, like it sort of changes. Doing the cheapest thing is never going to benefit low-income people, right? That's like where a lot of the harm comes in. But if you had people knew, you know, my daughter, when she was 5, she was arguing against going to school. She didn't want to go to school. So she tried to convince me that I would save a lot of money if I didn't send her to school. And then I told her that her education was free, and it blew her mind. And because she often listens to my conversation, she was like, wait, why are schools free but housing isn't? And I was like, that's the question. And so I think, you know, and I not that our free schools necessarily mean quality schools. So obviously we'd have to put in a lot of protections. We'd have to learn from that. But I think I do strongly believe, I mean, obviously I'm a lawyer and been a lawyer for many years. I do strongly believe that people need an enforceable right for it ever to happen. Mm.
And has that debate surfaced to the council level or the mayor level in DC yet? Do you know, in the history of the city?
Well, so the legal clinic frames its work around a right to housing. And so periodically things we advocate for get fought against by the mayor claiming we're advocating for a right to housing. So it's raised in that sense, but I always find that kind of humorous, because I'm like, you would know when we were advocating for a right to housing, like it would be pretty clear. This isn't that. But for instance, the Rapid Rehousing Reform Bill, and the mayor in her talking points opposing it suggested it created a right to housing, but like it doesn't in any way. It just creates a some rules and standards around exiting people. So it's only ever really raised in a sort of scary, oh, this is a right to housing, not really in a, we should have a right to housing. Which is, you know, means we have a long way to go. We hear council members sometimes say it would be different if we had a right to housing, and like maybe they would support that, but I don't see that getting a lot of traction. I think the cost of it overwhelms people, and they, when they think about how they would ever fund something like that.
I want to pause again to remind the listeners that we are in the spring pledge drive. We have a $600 goal this hour, and Empower DC has covered half of it. So just $300 to go to meet our goal. And I hope our listeners will chip in. You can call and talk to somebody here at 202-588-9739. Again, that's 202-588-9739. Or you can go to the website, WPFWFM.org, and select taking action from the drop down box. We really appreciate your support. And again, you know, I say this every pledge drive, but so much has changed in DC. We've lost so many institutions, Black and brown led places, gathering spaces, places of arts, entertainment, housing, everything else. We can't afford to lose WPFW. It is such an important institution to me. I hope it is to you as well. You're listening, so hopefully you agree. And if more of our listeners contributed during the drives, we would be in pretty good shape. So WPFW does need to keep its lights on, but it also needs to plan for an upcoming move. And your support at this time really means a lot. So please do consider donating, maybe becoming a sustaining monthly donor. And again, you can go to WPFWFM.org to donate now. Amber, is there, you know, we're hearing a lot about the budget being tight right now, and that right now the city council is in its final, you know, weeks of finalizing the budget. But you've been through a lot of budget fights. You know, what are the top things in our last few minutes here? What are the top things that you think DC residents should know about the budget and the budget process?
I mean, I think the most important thing to know is that there are nearly infinite number of choices when the council has the budget in front of them. And so I think hearing from people as to what their priorities should be is the most important thing any of us can do, because a lot of people will say something is a, like we heard a lot last week of council saying, this is a priority and this is a priority. But then they would say, but we're opposed to raising revenue, or, you know, and you're like, well, how much of a priority is it if you're not willing to do what it takes to get it funded? So for me, it's the how of how things get funded is so much less important than the funding. So if someone says they're committed to something, they need to have a plan for how they're going to fund it. And so our job is to say, this needs to be your highest priority, figure it out. And usually what we add to that is like, and don't take money from other programs the same clients use, because that's not helpful. You know, so, but I think just like hearing that, like there are revenue raisers out there that are progressive that council could pass that would raise millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so it's not that there's no money, it's that sometimes there just isn't sufficient political will. And I will say also that some people are louder than others in this community. You know, go to any social media forum and you'll see like a lot of the people that, you know, have probably very different values than you and I are very loud. And that's, I think it's a mistake if we let them carry the narrative and we let them drown us out. Because I think there are more of us that actually care about having a city that is actually inclusive, where everyone can live, no matter their income. I feel like there are more of us. We just sometimes aren't as loud. Or perhaps our elected officials, for some reason, don't feel as accountable to us. And I think it's up to us to change that.
And so if residents, listeners want to support the Washington Legal Clinic, we'll repeat the action here in a second, but just your work in general, or maybe access services from the clinic, how, you know, what types of folks should reach out to you and how can they do that?
So I think I mentioned we're very low barrier. So, you know, you don't actually have to be homeless to get our services, but anyone who needs help with an issue we have expertise in, we will help. We don't ask any questions about, you know, we aren't an organization that has to, you don't have to prove your income or your homelessness or your citizenship. None of that, none of those are even questions we ask. Mm. So if you have an issue that we have expertise in, we'll help. And it is, 202-328-5500 is our number to call. You'll speak to someone who will figure out if it's something we can help with and assign you to a free lawyer if it is. And if you want to get engaged in advocacy work, our director of community engagement is Lawan Brooks. And her, you can go to our website to get her email. That's probably the best way. And you can always email me. I'm amber@legalclinic.org. It's a very easy email address and I can direct you to whoever you need to talk to. But yeah, I mean, I think getting engaged in advocacy, coming to us if you need legal help, spreading the word, like Prisa said, not everyone knows about what's happening. And I think us talking about it more is helpful. I think the mayor really dominates the narrative in this city. She's got a lot more resources than we do to get her point of view across. So it's up to us to, you know, talk to our neighbors and talk to each other and share the information we have.
And again, listeners, we want you to just take a moment, go to legalclinic.org, look for the action alert tab and take action, send an email to the city council urging them to prevent 2,200 families from losing their housing. And Amber, if you could just give us your closing last couple minutes on this issue and why everybody should participate in that action.
Yeah, I think it is fixable. I think the council can fix it right now. They have the ability to do so. They just have to know that it is a priority for the community. So it's just really important that you either take that action or just reach out to your council member directly or any of the at-large ones and tell them that you care about making sure that everyone in the city has housing, and particularly that these families don't get terminated just for hitting an arbitrary time limit in the program because the mayor cut the program nearly in half.
Amber Harding has been my guest, executive director of Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. And Amber, just I really appreciate you. Thank you for your ongoing leadership. Amber is not afraid to stand up when council members or others are getting it wrong. And she also writes really great pieces on your blog, on your website, and sometimes for other outlets on these issues. So please read those and follow the Legal Clinic. They really are an important organization in our city. We're grateful to have them as partners. And thanks again, Amber, for being a guest today.
Thank you for having me.
So folks, go again to legalclinic.org, take that action, and of course, go to WPFWFM.org, make your donation. We didn't meet our goal this hour, sadly, so hopefully we'll make up for that with other shows exceeding their goals. But again, listeners, please contribute this pledge drive. You can call 202-588-9739, go to WPFWFM.org. Thanks for listening to Taking Action. Stay tuned for COVID, race, and democracy, but first, the news. We'll be right back.
Greetings. This is Interim General Manager Miyuki Williams. Thanks to all who have contributed to our spring drive, and we encourage those who haven't yet donated to do so by June 1st by calling 800-222-9739 or visiting wpfwfm.org. WPFW will be hosting an open house on Saturday, June 1st, 10 until 3 p.m. There will be books, CDs, and baked goods for sale. It is also an opportunity to gather with the WPFW family, programmers, local station board members, and other listeners and supporters. WPFW is located at 1990 K Street Northwest. All are welcome, but we ask that you RSVP at Eventbrite. Just search WPFW FM Open House. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, has issued an enforcement alert urging water utility systems to take immediate actions to protect the nation's drinking water from cyber attacks. According to the EPA, recent federal inspections revealed that 70% of American water systems do not fully comply with requirements in the Safe Drinking Water Act. The agency found that some water systems failed to change default passwords and cut off access to former employees, in addition to only using single logins for all staff that can be compromised. Possible impacts of cyber attacks include interruptions to water treatment and storage and damage to pumps and valves, along with alteration of chemical levels to hazardous amounts. A flight from London headed to Singapore turned deadly earlier today, leaving one man deceased and at least 30 injured. According to authorities, the Singapore Airlines flight fell into an air pocket while cabin crew were serving breakfast before it encountered severe turbulence, flinging passengers and crew around the cabin and forcing the plane to have an emergency landing in Bangkok, the capital of Thailand. A 28-year-old student who was aboard the flight described the tense situation by saying that the airplane started tilting upward, there was shaking, and then suddenly there was a very dramatic drop, so everyone who was seated and not wearing a seatbelt was launched immediately into the ceiling. Photographs from the plane's interior even showed large gashes in the overhead cabin panels from where passengers' heads hit those panels. A 73-year-old British man died during the incident, likely due to a heart attack. Singapore Airlines issued a statement expressing condolences to the family of the deceased and also apologized to all on board for the traumatic ordeal they experienced. To your local news, in New York City, Donald Trump's defense rested their case this morning after calling just two witnesses in the former president's historic criminal hush money trial. Trump did not take the stand today, despite repeatedly saying that he would be willing to testify in his own defense. The former president has been accused of taking part in an illegal conspiracy to undermine the integrity of the 2016 election and an unlawful plan to suppress negative information, which included a hush money payment made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels to hide her affair with Trump. Prosecutors allege that Trump disguised that transaction as a legal payment and falsified business records numerous times to promote his candidacy. For that, Donald Trump faces 34 counts of falsifying business records, which he has pleaded not guilty to. To the D.C. area, today, D.C. Attorney General Brian Schwab introduced new proposed legislation aimed at addressing youth crime in the district. The new bill focuses on the Department of Youth Rehabilitation Services, or DYRS. The bill is called the Recidivism Reduction, Oversight, and Accountability for DYRS Act of 2024, also known as the ROAD Act. Schwab's office says there are several ways that the ROAD Act aims to hold DYRS accountable for better outcomes regarding youth. For example, The ROAD Act requires DYRS to significantly reform its supervision and intervention practices to ensure that DYRS decisions for young people will lead to a reduction in recidivism or reoffending. Schwab said, and I quote, "While it is a small group of young people who are engaged in criminal behavior, that small group is causing a disproportionate amount of harm," end quote. In today's weather, it's currently about 80 degrees in New York and 84 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour.